Welcome to Come Inside.
My first guest of season two is Mary Buser. Mary worked as a clinical social worker in the mental health department on Rikers Island. She started out as an intern where she provided therapy to incarcerated women, including a support group for mothers in the island's nursery. After earning her master's degree, she returned to Rikers to work at a maximum security facility for male detainees. Here she provided both individual and group therapy to the general population. 3 years later, Mary was promoted to an assistant mental health chief. After working at Rikers Island for 5 years, she left and wrote a book called Lockdown on Rikers, shocking stories of abuse and injustice at New York's notorious jail. Mary was one of the more interesting people that I've spoken to because she worked at this notorious jail. There's not a single person in the crime field who does not know of Rikers Island and how there is just so much corruption and abuse of power. The injustice that goes on there is just heartbreaking. So it was really interesting to hear her experiences there. We also touched on a few other topics like the Black Lives Matter movement, solitary confinement, as well as a few other things. So I really enjoyed this chat. I hope you do too. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. My focus is really on human behavior and rehabilitation. So that's the reason why I decided to study it.
That sounds very interesting. And how did you have curiosity? How did you get my name?
Well, I've heard about the book, about Rikers Island, because it's so notorious. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. But I was watching on Netflix the thing about Kalief Browder. And I was like, oh, yeah, that name. I'm like, I know that name. Why do I know that name? And then I realized, and then I thought, oh, I should just reach out. I thought, we're all in lockdown. Maybe I'll get lucky.
I'm glad you did. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I find it really interesting to talk to just so many different people who have experienced different things and get all their opinions and that. So, yeah, I don't know. I think that there's a big problem with prisons are just overpopulated, and I just wonder if there's something we can do at a lower level, so in juvenile prisons, to stop that, to give them some hope. So that's kind of where I'm coming from, and yeah.
So your focus is on juveniles.
It is, but I'm not limited to that either, because I do communicate with some prisoners who are adults. Okay. And so I'm not necessarily just stuck to that. I just want to help people with something. It's so hard to like explain, but I just, any type of rehabilitation, even if they're, you know, never getting out of prison, I just think that they could still serve a purpose in there to teach people who might get out one day.
Yes. And that is something that I did write about in my book when I met with people who I knew were going away for life or long stretches. I still try to help them find the meaning, some meaning in their lives. Yeah.
And was that hard for them, do you think?
It was very sad.
Okay.
If someone is 22 years old and they're going away for 25 to life, there was a sadness about it. I don't know what you know about Rikers Island. I would recommend if you get a chance to read the book. It goes pretty quickly and you will get a ton of information that I think you would find helpful.
Yeah. I have ordered it actually. It's just everything's so slow at the moment.
I know.
I'm like, please come soon. Yeah.
I'm sure it will. But it's a good primer. You know, just to give you a little background about Rikers, Rikers is a jail complex.
Yeah.
So you understand that, okay?
Yes.
And you understand the difference between a jail and a prison, at least in the U.S.
I do, but maybe let's explain it just for the listeners so that I don't have to go into it.
Okay, so a jail is for people who have been arrested, charged with a crime, but typically don't have, when they're charged with a crime, typically bail is set. And if they pay it, let's say it's, $1,000, they go home while the case is being worked out.
Yep.
Because you're charged and arrested doesn't mean you're guilty.
Yep.
So there's a window. So if you can pay that, let's say, argument's sake, $1,000, you go home and talk to your lawyer and come into court, whatever. And in the end, you might go to prison, which is for people who have been sentenced.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might beat the charge. If you can't afford that $1,000, then they put you in New York City on Rikers Island.
Okay.
So it's really for the poor. It's for people who can't pay that bail. They're not necessarily guilty. They're behind bars because they can't afford to pay the bail,
yep.
which is something I really write about in my book, The Unfairness Towards the Poor. The bail is not a question of guilt or innocence. It's a question of money. So the people who were... So Rikers is a place of uncertainty.
Yep.
You know, people are hoping they're going to beat their charges and go home. Then they can't reach their lawyer. It's very hard to use phones. You're at a terrible disadvantage trying to fight your case from behind bars than if you're in your living room at home. You can never reach the lawyer. You only get 2 phone calls a day. So the stress level is very high. The hope that you're going to be exonerated versus the grim plunging despair that you're going upstate for, you know, to prison for years.
Okay.
So Rikers is a very, uncertain, unsettling place. So the people that I would sit with were, you know, I would know their charges, and, you know, there were some who there was no question they were going to go away for a long time. Others, you know, it might be 5 years. A lot of those charges could have probably been knocked down if they were on the outside and had good legal counsel. You know, then my job was basically sitting there and talking to someone and listening. There were a lot of tears, there were a lot of despair, and there was a lot of, that was what the therapy was around, is just a connection, a human connection with this person, trying to, I always believed, so many of the people who commit to jail, especially as teens and early 20s, there is such impulsiveness, immaturity. So, you know, I would try to work with them to help them to grow as
yeah.
human beings. And above and beyond the incarceration, I felt that that was still meaningful.
Yeah.
You know?
And do you think that that immaturity and them being so impulsive and that, has that come from their childhood? Have they not had a stable adult figure in their life to look up to?
Definitely. I'm actually working on another book right now, and I'm working with a man who's in his 40s, who is doing fine now, but got sent upstate. He went to Rikers Island for 2 years before his case was adjourned or resolved, and he was sentenced to, I think, I don't know, 15 years to life when he was only 16 years old.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting as he describes what his childhood was like. It's fascinating to me. And I think it's therapeutic for him to understand why he became the way he was. And he became a very violent criminal. He went upstate for attempted murder of a cop. He was in gangs, and certainly
yeah.
he was very violence prone, for sure.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to look back now with him as a more mature man. I think he's got more maturing to do, frankly, but he's certainly come a long way.
Yeah, and is he out of prison now?
Yes, he is. Successfully stayed out. He's married.
Oh, that's great. There is hope.
And there is hope.
Yeah.
I don't know if everyone got out, but he and I talked about that recently, that others didn't, and he did. And I mean, when he tells me things that he did, you know, I almost dropped the phone on the floor, like, oh my God. But as he describes his childhood, it really makes sense. And this book is kind of an analysis or a way for, I'm hoping, for people to see what goes into the reasons that someone turns into a violent teenager. winter.
Yeah.
Yeah. And emphatically to your question, yeah, definitely. How, and certainly based on my conversations to hundreds of people on Rikers, you know, they describe their childhoods, you know, you just sit there and go, you know, it's never had a chance, you know, if it was me, I would probably be the same way, you know?
Yeah. And that's such a concerning thing. When I hear people say that's not an excuse or this, that, the other, and I'm kind of like, but what chance did they have? Like, they had no hope because they had no one helping them, guiding them.
Right.
Yeah, and you need that. And I think people who have that don't realize that they have that and that they needed that as well. So,
right.
Yeah.
People who judge, I find, judge from the standpoint of their own background. Yes. And again, if I was in this person's shoes, as they described to me, the fear they grew up with, the absence of a parent who was always in prison, a mother who was shooting up heroin in the bedroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. You start to get the picture.
Absolutely.
Yeah, someone who was assaulted himself as a child on the street. What? It's not by accident that we all turn out the way we do.
Yeah.
You know, the nurturing, people, I think, underestimate or don't appreciate just how much the value of a nurturing parent. And even a parent who is dysfunctional, you know, it's a range. But you get into parents who, you know, again, your mother is shooting needles in her arm in the bedroom, and your father, you go to visit him in prison every once a year at Christmas. There's not much to go on.
No.
When you
look at the debate of nature versus nurture, I've always believed that it's both. I think both are equally as important. Some people argue that one's more important than the other. Do you have an opinion on where you stand with that?
Well, it's a good question, because I am sure there had to have been kids who grew up as deprived as he was, who did not, you know, succumb to the street life.
Yeah.
I tend to think that nurture, I don't think it's 50-50, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I certainly think that nature is in there, but I think nurture can sway that one way or the other. I think a good nurturing can overcome, you know, a child with great impulsivity is, I found, to be the big one in crimes and just reflexive behavior. And I think nurture would do a lot to mitigate that. So I think I'm inclined to think more nurture than nature, although nature is definitely, you know, you can have four children raised in the same household and there's one, you know, who is the problem.
How long did you work at Rikers for?
I worked at Rikers for 5 years.
You did different jobs there, right?
Yes. I started off as a student, as an intern.
Yep.
And then I came back after I got my master's degree, and I worked as a therapist. I started off working with women, actually, as a student.
Yep.
Then I came back as a therapist with men in one of the men's jails, which was a maximum security jail. Then I was promoted to an assistant chief of mental health.
Okay, so the United Nations say that anyone who's in solitary confinement for longer than 15 days, that represents torture.
Yeah.
Which I agree with. What do you think about it? Do you think there needs to be a ban on solitary confinement, or do you think that it serves a purpose if it's used correctly?
Well, I don't know how it could be used correctly.
True. I don't know what correctly is, but yeah.
Well, I've done a lot with this. Actually, the UN came out with this, and it was a man named Juan Mendez, who was the rapporteur on torture for the UN.
Yeah.
And and I was actually on a panel with him right around Christmas in Washington. It was a congressional briefing on solitary confinement. So I just like to throw that in there that I was a panelist with this
yeah.
man.
Yeah, you know.
But we didn't know each other. But it was a very important panel. Because legislators, they don't really understand what it's all about.
Yeah.
I certainly agree that beyond 15 days, it should not exist. I think up to 15 days, I think it's okay. You do get people who, when I worked at Rikers, with very severe mental, say schizophrenia, where stimulation or the quiet of a cell was actually helpful to them.
Okay.
But it was there. We would place them there until the medication took hold. And then once it did, they generally could. But that wasn't solitary. That was just cells that people would be in. They could still come out and all that jazz. But solitary itself is horrendous. And I know many survivors of it. I'm also with an organization called Social Workers and Allies Against Solitary Confinement. And its purpose is to kind of highlight the role of the helping professions working in there, because I don't know how you could sustain this practice without their participation. So, So when I first worked in the solitary unit, the first thing I was told was if they had no mental health issues before they entered solitary, they do now. So what that meant was that we were doling out so much medication for people to endure it, antipsychotics, antidepressants, sleeping pills, tons of meds. You know, and I remember thinking that, you know, what kind of a punishment is this that people have to be medicated in order to endure it?
Yeah.
And my job, and it was very distressing for me to learn what this was. I didn't really know before I got there. You know, on the island, they would talk about this unit, and they made it sound, they always said it's for the worst of the worst and the baddest of the bad, and you have to have this to protect everybody else and humankind from these people. Well, I got there only to discover that they were not particularly different from anybody else on Rikers Island.
Yeah.
And not only that, I started doing a little kind of informal research. You know, I had their charts, and as I would go to the cells and talk to people, I'd look to see why they were placed in solitary. I would say 3 out of 4 were there for an entirely nonviolent offense. So this is a big discovery, because what we're told across the United States is the worst of the worst, the baddest of the bad.
Yeah.
It's not true. And this has been borne out with other studies, particularly in New York State. So you get people who are put into solitary because they walked out of a housing unit wearing a hat, and you're not allowed to do that because you have too many postage stamps. I know a guy who's on the advisory board of our Social Workers Against Solitary and Allies. He was placed in solitary because he had too many bed sheets in his cell. This is horrendous when you discover the casual reasons that correctional staff throw people into solitary confinement.
Yeah.
And I'm not even touching on people with severe mental illness. This is everyday people, and the United Nations says after 15 days it's torture. It's outrageous. It's horrible. And every single day that I worked there, I would get called to a cell door. And there was a team of us, a psychiatrist, a therapist, and when I was the assistant chief, and, you know, we would go to the door. And there's the suicide threats, the suicide gestures. I never saw so much blood in my life. Cut arms, makeshift nooses. Just desperate, desperate people to get out, would do anything. And it was just horrendous. And we couldn't just let people out because this was the punishment. And the only way we could let someone out is if we thought that the risk was very high that they were actually going to die. Okay. And it was outrageous. I was like, how can we be asked to make decisions like that? And how can we be witnesses to this? And, you know, I started off to help people and found myself in a situation where we were just like monitors of human suffering.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is something that the public has, it's all out of sight. No one can see it. But in the United States, there's about 80,000 people in solitary confinement. And, you know, we don't see these people. And in some of these cells, lights are kept on 24/7. They don't know whether it's day or night. This is torture, out and out torture. Some others, there's no uniformity from one prison to another. So you could have some that might have a window, others don't. It all depends. Now, last year or so, there has been one state, which is Colorado, that decided this is inhumane and we're going to do something about it. And the governor, actually, of Colorado authorized the head of the Colorado Department of Corrections to find a humane alternative to solitary confinement. And they had about 1,500 people in the state of Colorado in solitary. Some of them have been in there like 10 years.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So this is a story. The guy who, the head of it, agreed that he would work on this. And while he was researching, and they had no idea, no other state, it was all, you know, trying to figure this out for themselves. A guy was released from solitary confinement, and with all the hype about protecting people by putting them in solitary, his prison sentence had ended and he was in solitary. So they simply took him out of solitary and released him to the streets.
Oh my God. Which,
yeah. Could you imagine? And you're saying we're protecting people once the sentence was up, just without a care or a thought. Someone who'd been in solitary for, I think, 2 years, just took him out and you go home now. Well, people are very damaged by this whole experience. And what he did was he went to the home of that head of the Colorado Department of Corrections with a gun, knocked on the door. The head opened the door and he shot him and killed him.
Oh.
And yeah, yeah.
I mean, what do you expect, right?
Yeah,
it's horrible that happened, but what do you expect? How can you keep someone in there for 2 years, which is ridiculous, and then just put them on the street? Like, of course.
Exactly.
Like, where's the transition? That is terrible,
yeah.
I didn't realize I don't agree with solitary at all, but I didn't realize how bad it was that, you know, for putting a hat on or having too many bed sheets. How can the officers get away with that? How are they allowed?
They don't tell you any of that. What they tell you, they don't tell the public. That's why it takes people going in there and seeing it up close and going, oh my God, this is nothing like the what we're all sold about it. It isn't. It's a lie. So the irony is that this man was actually trying to reform solitary, but he was not killed. So the governor wisely agreed, like, look what it does. I want to continue. So he brought in another reform-minded man to head up Colorado, and he did. And it took him a few years to get from 1,500 people down to one.
Wow.
And you would have thought that the prisons in Colorado would have fallen apart, but they didn't. And in fact, violence decreased.
Decreased. Ah, yep. See, we're sold the story that it will increase.
It decreased.
Yeah.
And I was invited to go. I went and visited three of the prisons and walked around with a team of people I work with, including a guy who I told you before was in solitary for too many bed sheets. He came on this trip. And we got to talk to so many people, you know, I talked to this one guy who just said I was in for 10 years and one day the door opened, the warden came in and said, you know, we want you to come out. We're going to give you therapy. We're going to help you. Do you think you can, and this guy was violent.
Yeah.
Refrain from violence. So he said to me and my colleagues, he said, well, he said, I figured he was going to try, I'd do my part. So he's been out for several years now without one violent incident. And the thing is that I'd say most people are not in there for anything violent, but do have people who are in there for violence.
Yes.
So what do? You have to have something in place. You can't just, you've got to have something in place. And that's what they understood. And what they replaced it with was they went with the UN 15 days. And instead of 1 hour out, it's now 4 hours out. But an hour has to be in therapy, and it's very prescribed.
Okay.
And then you go, it's like steps, and then the window increases with the goal of getting you back into population. And it's working. And we got to meet the officers. We got to meet people who were, a lot of people who had been in solitary for years. And my one colleague, the guy who was actually himself directly impacted with the sheets, he pulled me aside and he said, this is all too good to be true. I'm going to do a little reconnaissance work. So while we were walking around talking to, you know, various prisoners, he grabbed one of the prisoners and said, come here. He walked down the hall and the correctional staff let us. They said, talk to whoever you want, do whatever you want. So he went into his cell and he said, look, yeah, man, I've been where you are. You got to tell me straight up, you know, is this a marketing show for us or is this real? And the guy said, you know what? He said, it's real. And he said, if they had been doing this years ago when I came in as a kid, he said, I never would have been back because now the focus is on rehabilitation, therapy, group therapy, use of time, all kind of a million programs. They changed the culture of the whole place. They did it. And the violence dropped and the assaults on staff in particular dropped.
Wow.
And it was the most amazing thing. Yeah. And we might be doing, we hope this year to be doing a Zoom conference on that whole Colorado visit because it's not publicized enough just how, you know, effective it is, how groundbreaking it is and humane.
Yeah.
So I've seen the worst of it, and I've also got to see firsthand how it could be different.
Do you think that if solitary was turned into what you saw in Colorado, where they were still allowed out, and then the therapy and all that, it has its place for really violent people that are causing fights, maybe they're stabbing prison guards, whatever they're doing. Do you think it has a place for that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Those are the numbers that went down.
Yeah.
See, this is, here's what's something really interesting also, is that there were two psychiatrists, they're called Dr. Gilligan and Lee, Bandy Lee, and I forget Gilligan's first name, but I've been on some panels with Dr. Lee, and they worked in California. And they went into a prison in California, and they were permitted to work with people in solitary, have them all taken out, and they said, we will work with them. And they were told, well, you're going to get killed if we let these people out. Their hypothesis was that people who are violent have been under-socialized when they're growing up. And by putting them in solitary, all you're doing is creating an even more violent person.
Yeah.
But if you do the opposite, start to socialize them, they're going to become less and less violent. So somehow they got the green light to do this study, and it was amazing. They went in there, and everyone who was in solitary, it was a small prison, but everyone in solitary was put in a dorm. And they were nervous, but they said they did like 24-hour day therapy, got these people talking. It, obviously not 24 hours a day, but
no.
they were in groups. They were in individual therapy, group therapy, outside recreation, to get them more sufficiently socialized, able to express themselves, to interact more normally. And they did this, I think, over a course of a year, and the incidence of violence dropped to zero.
Wow.
So
yeah,
this was huge. And I think if you Google them, Gilligan and Lee, you would probably find that study. And yeah, I just thought that was so profound and so meaningful, you know, and I think they're right on, people who have not been well socialized, you know, they don't know how. All they know is
violence.
You know, it's true though. I remember as a Rikers, I remember people coming and they would need to make a phone call. So I would arrange when they could make a phone call. They would look at me because they needed to talk to an outside agency, and they would look to me to do it for them. And at first I thought, no, you have to do it yourself, and I'm not going to, you know, support that I not do for you, until I realized they don't know how.
Yeah.
They don't say, though they can say, yo, you know, what the fuck?
Yeah.
All the little things that we learn as we grow up that we don't even realize went into our nurturing and upbringing that was not in theirs.
Yeah.
And they just looked at me helplessly, and then, you know, I would do for them, or, and I would model, let them try it a little bit. They'd still hand the phone to me, whatever. I don't know how. So there's a lot here.
There is. Yeah, there really is. Why do you think that so many states and so many prisons are against moving towards that type of solitary therapy, that environment that you just explained? Why are they against it?
Well, that's a really great question. The man who was in charge of Colorado, his name was Rick Ramish. He has since retired. And what he said was that putting people in solitary confinement makes management of the facility much easier. There's a lot less work. Everybody's in a cell. You have to do a lot less. Life is easier. And he said, but that's not an excuse to do it. So I think there's the management part of it.
Yeah.
I think there's also, in my experience, there's a great resistance to what's perceived as outside meddling. We know that's not you. Don't, a real resistance to any type of change. Kind of like, you know, we're dealing with the most difficult people. Now don't tell us how to do it, kind of an attitude.
Yeah.
It's a real us versus them attitude. In order for this to have worked in Colorado, it required a culture change. And a lot of the guards quit when this guy really started to institute change. He meant it. It wasn't lip service. The ones who stayed, I got to talk to them. And one guy in particular said, in the beginning, he was like, F this, you know, I'm not doing it. But he said, I didn't have another job to go to. So he said, I hung in, and I never expected it to work, but he said it did. And he said, and I saw that it was working. And he said, honestly, what happened was the changes here have been my own rehabilitation. And he said, it's no longer horrible job to go to every day, you know, because they are, you can see kind of a, I don't want to say a camaraderie, but a care.
Yeah.
You know, we all went to, there was a woman who had acted out violently. So she was back in a cell, and we got to meet her, and the officers were there, and we were there, and she had just served, like, they didn't even make it 15 days, maybe 7, with 1 hour out before they increased the window of time out. And everybody was saying to her, let's say her name was Jane, including the officers, you know, what happened, Jane? And she was shaking her head saying, I don't know, I don't know. I didn't want it to happen. I tried. And they were saying to her, you're going to get it next time. You're going to get it. And I was like, this is unimaginable on Rikers Island, just unimaginable.
Oh, yes. Did you witness any or experience any corruption or violence and that? Because it's quite notorious for things like that. On Rikers, I mean.
Oh. Oh, yes. Oh, my God, yes.
I feel like there's a lot of stories.
Well, yeah. And I read a lot about that, about how I do type of thing, the moral dilemma.
Yeah.
Oh, it's rampant, not only at Rikers, but everywhere. But Rikers is a microcosm,
yeah,
I'm convinced, for the rest of the country. But, yeah, people would come, and they'd come with black eyes. They'd come with their teeth. They would have had their teeth the previous week. Their teeth are gone. What happened? Would describe, whispering, being sure that, you know, guards couldn't hear them, telling me how, what happened. The beat-up squad coming in, beating everybody up. Or if someone, in one case, this guy got beaten up and he reported the officer, and he got, Rikers is a bunch of jails, like a campus. So we got moved from that jail to my jail. But we're between the guards, traveled from jail to jail. And they simply came in, and where he'd been beaten up originally, he had his arm in a sling, and he was brought from the hospital. And they said, who is it? Who's the guy who filed something against another officer? And there he is with the sling. It's obvious it's him. And they just attacked him, and they just stomped on his arm and kicked out the pins. And just horrible, horrible, horrible.
And what happened to those guards? Anything?
Nothing.
So there's no consequences?
No. So,
it just makes I just can't fathom it.
Well, I'll give you, here's an example that I dealt with. I remember a guy who was severely had bipolar disorder, and he was in the manic phase, and he was irritating everyone. And people in that phase are the most vulnerable. And anyway, he got pulled aside into a dark hall, and, you know, they knocked out his teeth and broke his nose. Horrible. And he was just a sweet man who was just lost. He never did anything violent in his life.
Yeah.
Just lost. And anyway, it to this day, it just breaks my heart. And I just said, you know, do you know who they were? We're going to report them. And this is something that I would say to a lot of them. And the reaction was always the same. No. I thought I told you this in confidence. And I would be like, well, you have, but don't you want justice? And they said, don't you get it? Next time they'll kill me. So the problem is that to point a finger at a cap door is very dangerous. Very dangerous.
They almost seem more dangerous than some of the inmates.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, which is just scary.
It is. It is. And that's a very good observation, but that's, they would all say that. They're the scary ones. Or they'll say they're the biggest gang in here, them.
Yeah. I guess it's no wonder that they have no hope, really, if they are to be released, because now they've got all that built-up anger and resentment at a system that didn't work.
I would say so, yes. Yes.
Yeah,
as well as the fact that now they've got a felony, and that makes it very hard to get a mainstream job. You're relegated to fringes now.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Were you at Rikers when Kalief Browder was there?
No, I was not.
Okay.
But I've met his brother, and I was asked if I would be able to meet with his mother, which I was not able to do for a variety of reasons. It's very sad because she had died.
Yeah. When I look at his case, it's really sad that he ended up taking his own life, but it's unsurprising as well. And the violence and, you know, the footage of the guards just kind of standing around and, like, the guards beating him up as well. And it's like nothing happens to these people, but here's this young 16-year-old who's accused of stealing a backpack and, you know, I don't even know what to say about it. I just find it heartbreaking, that whole story.
Oh, it's so heartbreaking.
And it's probably really common.
Yes, exactly. That's not isolated.
Yeah.
And his story made it to the front covers, and thank God it did, you know, that he didn't die in vain, because that just woke everything up in a very big way, very big way. And it just, you just see his face and you just, you know, you just cry. It just absolutely shamed not only the guards and all the jails, but the system itself that can hold a 16-year-old for 3 years over nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, just hold him like that. It's just the shame and the disgrace. Everyone needed to have been disgraced, ashamed by what happened to him.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Have you found that, you know, maybe in Rikers or just in general in prisons, there seems to be a way bigger population of African American?
Oh, yes. Oh, there is. And, you know, I wrote that too, you know, in my book, when I walked down the tiers in solitary confinement, the faces all dark-skinned, no question about it. It was rare that you would see a white face. It was mainly black and Hispanic.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people in there for marijuana charges. And I would just say to myself, well, how come, what does this mean, that white kids don't smoke pot?
Yeah.
No, it's the police. Exactly. Yeah, I'm like, well, I don't get it. You know, it's where the police are targeting.
Yeah.
They're going to the poorer neighborhoods. They're not going to college campuses where easily everyone is smoking pot and selling pot there.
Yeah.
Because there'd be hell to pay. So, you know, people who say, well, don't do the crime, you know, or if you don't want to, but that's such an oversimplification.
Yes.
You know, if you work it backwards, talk to the police. Where are the white faces? Don't tell me they're not smoking pot. We know they are.
Exactly.
And the consequences are just horrible. Oh, just horrible.
Even when you look at cases, like I was reading about, this is a while ago, I won't be able to remember the name of the judge, but he had two cases in front of him, exactly the same crime. One was Caucasian, one was African American. Mm-hmm. The sentences were so out of whack. It was ridiculous. And it was for something like having pot. And the African American was almost like put away for life, whereas the Caucasian guy got pretty much a slap on the hand. It's like, how, this is why people are losing their minds at the moment and trying to be heard by marching, because it's like, how many people, how many George Floyds, you know, there's an endless list of names we could go through. How many of them have to die and be mistreated over nothing with no one being held responsible? So what do you think about these marches and things like that? Do you think they're helping? Some people don't think they're helping. What do you think?
Well, I certainly support the whole Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah.
I mean, just what you said. I mean, all of these marches, they didn't erupt over just George Floyd.
No.
As horrible as that was. This has been coming and coming, you know, building and building, and boom, it went. And it needed to. It just needed to happen. I remember when I was on Rikers, when I was working as a therapist, the chief telling me, go down to what's called the mental observation unit for people who, you know, had some psychiatric distress, depression to schizophrenia. She said, there is someone down there who the judge just called. They're trying to arrange for him to go to some place for treatment, and I need you to do a psychosocial, which is like an assessment, a psych assessment.
Yep.
And she said, so we can get this sent to the place, because the judge doesn't want him to have a felony, and so we're going to do everything we can to help this guy. So I said, okay, sure. And I ran down there, and only when I got to the gate to go into that unit did I realize I hadn't asked for his name. But as soon as that gate opened and I was standing in the dorm with everyone, I just instinctively looked for the white face.
Yeah.
And that's who it was. And it's not, you know, the judge said he's basically a good kid, and that's what she told me, he said on this phone call. So I did it. But I thought, how many of these black kids are good kids? There's just no one to go to bat for them.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. No one in a high place to go to bat for them. They can just go right through the cracks. And it just was heartbreaking, just utterly heartbreaking, because so many of them were good people who needed some guidance. Some were violent. Most were not. But they're all getting slapped with felonies, which means when they came out, you can't get a job now.
Yeah.
Now you're forever a fringe type existence.
Yeah, totally.
So I just saw the terrible inequity in there. Just the way the police target for their arrest. And just as you said, the Caucasian getting this mild sentence compared to the black guy. Yeah, they did something here, which I thought was interesting. Newspaper. They put two news heads next to each other on something on social media, but one was a picture of a white guy and the other was a black guy. It was very similar crimes, whatever it was. But for the white guy, it said, you know, youth arrested for blah, blah, blah. And then for the same offense, under the black guy, it said, thug arrested.
Ugh.
You know?
Yeah.
So you're sitting right there, you know? Yeah. The black guy is a thug. The white guy is a youth. There is this built-in perceptions, and they have very horrible consequences for people.
How do we change it?
To your question, are these marches helping or hurting? Yeah, I don't know. I think ultimately helping, I really do.
Yeah.
I don't think we're, I really do. I think it's worth it. You know, you're seeing people addressing this in ways I've never seen before. It's like a big time out. I do think some changes are going to stick. Now, you do see people who are very irritated by it. I feel like a lot of them just don't understand it. What they're focusing is people who are violent during these protests. And unfortunately, that's what makes it into newspapers, because that's, you know, people marching peacefully is not very newsworthy as much as someone, you know, who does something violent and disruptive. But the vast, vast majority of marchers have been totally peaceful.
Yeah.
And I wish that got more play than it does, but I guess it doesn't get that many clicks.
No. Well, with the violence that happened and looting and all that, I felt like that was caused by people taking advantage of the situation rather than people wanting to march for change.
Yeah, the people who wanted to march for change were not interested in violence.
Breaking windows and, lighting cars on fire. But I also get how it boils over. They're frustrated. They've had enough.
Yes, yes, yes. And I do too.
Yeah.
I do too. Not that I condone it, but I do too. I mean, gee whiz. The thing is with George Floyd, that got caught on cameras.
Yeah.
What doesn't get caught on camera? Oh, my God. I just don't even want to think about it. And I do think that, you know, the day of reckoning is coming for the police. You know, they never, ever, what bugs me about them is they never say, we need to do better. We need to genuinely police our own. It's just lip service. They never do much about their own misbehavior. They just don't, they seem incapable of policing themselves. And then there have to be consequences.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to be held more accountable. And I do think that their powers need to be reduced. I certainly think that society needs to find a better solution for people with severe mental illness. are kind of shirking that responsibility, letting the police do it and putting them on Rikers Island. And take some of that police money and build whatever you need to build to make it humane and workable for you know, real treatment for people who, you know, who pose real challenges. Give them some comfort and some care. Don't cast them out, you know, to the streets, you know, the way we do. It's terrible.
It really is. And, you know, people, like, there's a big movement around defunding the police. People don't understand what that means. They think it means just completely getting rid of the police, which is not what they're talking about. They're talking more about what you were just saying, which is reducing the police's power and their budgets and putting that money into educating and investing into these poorer communities. Do you think that is a really, really good idea?
I do.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I think. You need the police. They can't be the answer to every societal problem. We see the results, the brutalization of people with severe mental illness, and they shouldn't be in jail to begin with. I don't understand why they get so extreme. That it gets very polarizing.
Yes.
You know, like defund the police and then, you know, oh, then where will we all be? And you people are crazy to defund them, you know. And no. It's an umbrella term and
it has
shades of meaning, and it's just too many examples of how badly they manage situations with people with severe mental illness. Just terrible. They just traumatize people horribly and brutalize them.
Absolutely.
And they let them fight crime or direct traffic, but you know. No.
Yeah, they can't be the judge, the jury, and the executioner, which is kind of what it seems like. Like, they got too much power.
Exactly. They have way too much power.
And
they get so angry if you try and curb their power.
Absolutely. And there's just no consequences for them, which I just can't understand. Like, how?
Yeah.
You know, it's just...
I mean... Well, I don't know if you heard of Eric Garner.
I was just about to say that.
Chokehold. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it took 5 years to fire him. And the police commissioner did it and said it was one of the hardest things he ever did. And they all felt betrayed by him. And for God's sakes.
You
know.
He killed someone.
He should have been fired immediately.
Yeah. Heck, like if I walked down the street and put my knee on someone's neck, I'd be going to prison. Why can a police officer do that and really face nothing? It's just not.
Right.
And they're so violent about it, and it's just, it's horrible to watch, but it's important that we keep watching them.
I agree. As much as you don't want to watch, we have to.
We have to, yeah.
And have to hold them accountable and make noise and pressure politicians to shape up. And also, take some of their money away. At least in New York City, they get billions and billions of dollars. And
yeah, absolutely. I just want to ask you one more thing about Rikers Island. It's due to be shut down in 2026, I believe. Do you agree? That's the thought. Is it going to happen? Do you agree with that decision? I mean, what's going to happen with all those people?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's a done deal at all.
Oh, you don't think it's a done deal? They've been talking about it for years.
I know. Boy, I know. I was in the middle of it, and I testified at City Hall and all kinds of things, you know, before the City Council. One of the reasons I don't think it's a done deal is because COVID is, like, bankrupted the city, and it will take about, you know, they're estimating $8 billion to build these new jails.
Wow.
I have no idea where that money, just from that standpoint, I don't know where that money's going to come from. And I also have a friend who's the former treasurer of the city of New York, and she just said there's no money for anything.
No.
There's no money, like, set aside, you know, in an account at all. So there's that. But that aside, I have mixed feelings about it, to tell you the truth. A shutdown is not a magic wand.
No.
Let's put it that way.
No. Well, it doesn't change the corrupt system, does it? So
no.
They may as well.
No, it doesn't. And there's
yeah.
Yeah, there's a million things that go into making Rikers the horror that it has become. And you don't undo that or change that just by changing the address.
No.
Or you don't. So I have real concerns that everybody then goes home like our work is done. And it's not done at all. I do think that the proximity, and because the people who are on Rikers are the poor and the families do not have cars, it makes it very difficult for families to get there.
Yeah.
So one advantage to me of putting the jails in the boroughs would be the proximity and enabling families to take public transportation to visit a loved one. It is hellacious to get to Rikers.
Okay.
It's hard to get
yeah.
there. Yeah. Without it, if you don't have a car.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah.
There's an argument that, like you said, you know, spending $8 billion to essentially change the address, or people are saying, why would we spend that much money? Why don't we just spend the money to improve what's already there?
Meaning the structures that are there?
Yeah, and I think giving it a whole overhaul.
Well,
I mean, it sounds easier than it is, I'm sure.
Well, I would like to see, ideally, I mean, it wouldn't take $8 billion to overhaul it right there at all. It would take far less.
Yeah.
But then I'd like to see them take that money and put it into the communities.
That's true.
And create express buses that go right there, that are free, that run all the time to take families there. But then put that money into bail funds that the poor get bailed out. We have had laws now, bail reform laws, that were enacted January 1st. The police just about had, you know, multiple heart attacks over it. There were some rollbacks to it, but not too bad, not too many.
Okay.
Because the police got caught lying several times, saying crime is increasing because of rollback due to the reform laws, bail reform laws. And then they did a study on it and found out that 11,000 people showed up for their court hearings and one was rearrested. So all of their shouting and fear-mongering is getting hopefully shown for what it is. But, you know, I would not be opposed to keeping it there as long as people can get there. And also, if you could take that rest of that money and put it into drug treatment in the community, mental health treatment in the community, so that that population just becomes just violent people who, let's say, domestic abusers, things like that,
yeah.
need to be held there. But their cases have to be, you know, a speedy trial has to mean something. You can't, like a Khalif Browder, sit there for 3 years over a backpack.
Ridiculous. That.
So there's, yeah. But you also, they make visiting people very difficult as well. So whether that's on Rikers or in the boroughs, unless the correctional staff just make it so horrible, that's another barrier to visits. And visits are very important. They help. It's a lifeline for people.
Yeah.
Connection to family.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Have you noticed, I mean, we've kind of touched on it, but have you noticed any other, like, similarities that criminals may have? So, you know, is it just about them growing up in poverty and addiction, they've been abused? Are they the main things? Are there other things as well? Because how often do you see a rich white boy sitting in prison?
Not often.
Yeah.
But what they have in common too is age.
Okay.
Their ages, their impulse, there's great impulsivity. And their brains are not fully developed, the human brain, until you're about 26. So they are super impulsive, reflexive. And this is where nurturing and nurturing family would help to hold that in check, where without any nurturing, they act on all kinds of crazy things.
Is there anything else we can do to help them not be so impulsive? Like, can it be taught in school, or, like, is there something that can help?
It's a very good question, though. because when I went to Colorado, where the prisons where they got rid of solitary,
yeah,
I got to meet this guy who'd been in solitary, who I don't know if he'll ever get out of prison. I think he's a very violent guy. But he told us, you know, we stood there, he's very proud of himself. And he said that something happened where a guard was supposed to come and get him to take him to rec or something. And he said he didn't come. And he said, usually I would flip out. I would scream. I would curse. I would cut myself. I would try to cut somebody else. But he said now, he said through my therapy, he said I've learned to try and think of reasons why the guard didn't come before I flip out. So we said, oh, very good, very good. You know, what did you come up with? He said, okay, he had a little list in a pad. He said, number one, the guard didn't come because he just learned that his mother died.
Oh, that was the first
and
one?
He said, yeah, and we were like, yes, his mother could have died. He said, and he was so proud of himself. He said, he didn't come because the guard he was waiting on to relieve him couldn't come to me because his mother died.
Oh, God.
That could be a reason. Yeah. But he came up with 10 reasons, and he was so proud of himself that he put a little space between getting triggered and reacting. And that was some type, I think they used CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. I think they were using that there.
Yeah.
So that was helping him. And this guy I'm working on writing this book, he also, we've talked about how he has learned this whole thing, it's all new to him as he was getting older and more mature, of putting space between getting triggered and reacting. And he said he learned that he said they had anger management classes. And he said a lot of guys said, oh, that's all bull. He goes, but I went to them, and he said, I learned. And he said, it did help me. It made sense. So interventions, I think therapy is very important behind bars, and people do learn. And that guy was the ultimate there with, aha, his mother died.
Yeah.
And then he said, I finally came and said, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, whatever. And I said to him, oh, that's okay. And we all kind of clapped, you know, very good, you know. This was huge for this guy.
Yeah, it really is. It sounds like, he almost sounds like a kid that didn't flip out because the toy wasn't working and he was just so happy that he was able to make sense of it. So, I mean, I agree with the therapy thing. Yeah. I'm just wondering, I feel like a lot of the time society waits for it to get to that point and then we try to do something. How can we do something before it gets to that point? How do we intervene beforehand?
Yeah. That's exactly what I think, if it's not in my book, it wasn't, it got edited out, I forget, but I said we spent huge sums of money on the back end.
Yeah.
Why can't we invest that, intervene hard early on?
Yeah. Do you think it's education? Do you think that's where we need to start it?
Well, I think education is one piece of it.
Yeah,
I think
of course.
If I saw interventions, I would see really first good quality daycare for little ones whose mothers might be on drugs.
Yeah.
Something really nurturing, good food, and support for mom. But, you know, in communities that are so fractured, a substitute for a family, I think, would be a very important place to give them some kind of a platform of love and community and care.
Yeah.
Again, this guy, I'm writing the book. Oh my God, he was just on his own. You know, he was handed a gun when he was 8 years old.
Wow.
You know, just off the charts.
Yeah.
So I would see it really coming in there very young with identifying, you know, neighborhoods or whatever and just giving big time support.
Yeah, I agree. Support. I think closing the gap needs to be a priority because I've never understood how you could have someone who owns a $1 million yacht, but then you've got someone in a community that's sleeping on a park bench. Like, how can you have those two things in the same state even? We've got to close that gap because it seems like the poor are getting poorer and the rich are getting richer, and it's just not helping.
Seems that.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
It's horrible.
Yeah, I agree.
I've only got a couple more questions. You've been very generous with your time. I just want to know, what are your thoughts on the death penalty? Do you think it's a deterrent or...
No.
Yeah. I love it. Straight out. No, I agree. I don't think it's a deterrent at all. We don't have it here in Australia.
Wow.
Which is, and they've never had it here in my lifetime anyway. I can't imagine living somewhere that does have it. I just find it gobsmacking.
It's so barbaric.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you would find it hard to live in a country that has it. It's horrific, and Texas is one of the worst states for it. And I have no desire to ever visit that state just because for that reason.
Yeah.
No, it's not a deterrent.
Well, it can't be. There's so many people on death row, right?
Yeah. And people, when they commit a crime, they don't stop and think, oh, wait a minute.
No.
It's not how it works. And to me, aren't we better? Aren't we supposed to be better? I don't. And it's horrendous. We'll keep people in solitary confinement on death row for 20 years before we kill them. At this point, we're worse than whatever it is that they did, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree. Some people think that that's what they deserve, but they still have rights. You can't be inhumane. They've still got to have human rights, and it just doesn't seem like they do. But also, I keep, all these cases, and there's been a few executions this year, like you said, in Texas, who are just horrible, where there's evidence that shows that they were innocent, or there's DNA evidence that, the government are refusing to test that could exonerate them, and instead they just go ahead and execute them. How is that justice?
It's not.
Yeah.
It's not. And it's usually a person of color who's being executed too.
Yeah. Have you ever been to a death row prison?
No, I have not.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you ever read Dead Man Walking. Sister Jean wrote that book. Yeah. She also wrote a blurb on my book cover, so I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. So she's one of my heroes, and I thought of her when I was working there because she had a saying, it's not enough to be kind in an unjust system.
Oh, yeah.
So I was really taken with that. But yeah, not much more to say.
What do you think is a good way to help criminals be rehabilitated? So, we've spoken about therapy and resocialization. Is there other things that you think could help?
Well, I think things should be happening while they're still behind bars to prepare them. I think there should be real good action plans to connect people with resources in the community, with housing, with a platform for them to have a shot.
Yeah.
Just to give you, car fare, dump you off somewhere after 10 years, what really can a person do? I think that a lot should happen before you're released. That's prepping you and prepping you for success.
Yeah.
Not for a gotcha parole system to be put you right back in again.
Yeah. Do you think they need to be running some sort of educational classes and things like that in the prison while you're there to teach you how to transition and how to do certain things once you're out? Yeah.
Yeah. People do much better. I mean, I don't know if there are studies, but everything I see indicates that where people have educational opportunities, especially as they start to get older behind bars, they take advantage. They learn.
Yeah.
It gives them a big leg up, for sure. It's very important.
That's very
true. To invest money in education, yes.
Yeah.
And again, connecting them with resources. And again, in Colorado, they did a lot of this.
Yeah.
They had outside groups and professional organizations who came in and spoke and let them adopt a person to kind of look after them once. They had all these things to try and help someone succeed. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
They were committed to doing it. They wanted to do this.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time. I've taken up an hour and a half.
That's okay.
It's
near and dear to my heart.
So yeah, I've really enjoyed this chat. I have learned a lot, actually. And it's always interesting to talk to someone who's actually there in the system, working on Rikers and stuff. So thank you so much. I'm extremely grateful.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Yes.
And, you know, good luck with everything.
Yeah, thank you.
If you have any other questions or whatever, feel free to reach out.
Thanks for listening. So until next time, be the change the world needs. But for now, school's out, class dismissed.